The following lecture was delivered at the 17th Annual National Jewish Retreat in Palm Desert, California, a project of the Rohr Jewish Learning Institute. We hope you enjoy it. We encourage you to visit jretreat.com for information on upcoming retreats. Rabbi Yitzchak Shachet now presents his lecture, Yisker, Here and Beyond.
Gerda Kohl was a young Jewish girl when she fled her native Vienna, which was already annexed by Germany at the onset of the Holocaust in 1939. And she arrived in England as part of the Kinder Transport, who, as you well know, brought many Jewish minors across Europe to Allied territories. Ultimately, her mother managed to survive the war, but alas, her father was murdered by the Nazis. And this Gerda, as a young child, found it very difficult to assimilate into her surrounds. And at 18, just being carefree and not really having any direction, she felt pregnant. She was unemployed. She had very few prospects. And when she gave birth to this baby girl, whom she named Sonia, in 1942, because of her whole predicament and because of her economic situation, she was advised by the refugee committee in England to place her baby up for adoption. And she was told, from this point onward, you can't have any further contact with your child. In her own words, "I had very limited personal education, and this combined with wartime and having a baby at 18 left me with no recourse but to have my daughter, Sonia, adopted under the advice of the refugee committee, and the condition was not to have any further connection with my child." Of course, she's heartbroken to let her daughter go, but she knew, nevertheless, my daughter is going to have a much better life with the German family that she gave them up to. Yes, a German family now living in the UK. Not to say that she ever stopped thinking about her. She obviously always wondered about her, where she was, what she was doing, what she was accomplishing in life, at times even contemplating perhaps going in pursuit in trying to find her. But then knowing that that might be a mistake, who knows what the consequences would be, and always looking to find comfort in her heart, knowing that at least Sonia will be living somewhere, having a good life. There were times that she felt overwhelmed, but ultimately always appreciated that I need to get on with life, I need to move on. She went on and she involved herself volunteering at archaeological digs in Israel and in Cyprus, etc. Stephen Grist, that's a young man's name, he was Sonia's son. And only recently, as a result of Brexit, which I presume you're all familiar with, that's when Britain decided to go on its own and break away from the rest of Europe, like many, many other people who would otherwise now be stuck in lines for long periods of time in the rest of Europe, decided that he wanted to explore the option of obtaining a European passport. So he took his mother, Sonia's birth certificate, and started to trace his roots using all those genealogical websites, which he hoped would lead him to European citizenship. He knew that he had a maternal grandmother called Gerda Kohl, but now he needed to obtain a death certificate. And so he determined that his grandmother had been married 5 times, and it was on Facebook that he was actually able to make contact with one of Gerda's stepsons. And he reached out to him and he asked, "Look, I am Sonia, Gerda's daughter's son. Effectively, you and I guess, are stepbrothers in some way, but I'm wondering, or a step-uncle, I'm wondering if there's any way that you can help me obtain a death certificate of Gerda, your stepmom, so that I would be able to get myself a European passport." To which the stepson replied, "I'm afraid that's going to be impossible, because she's at the Rivera Kennedy Lodge long-term care home in Toronto, Canada." And you could have knocked Stephen over with a feather. He waited a whole 2 weeks before he summoned the courage to tell his mother that her mother was still alive, gone for 80 years. And Sonia shook with speechless emotion and then insisted on catching the first flight out of London to join her mother in Canada. And so it was last year, on May 7th, 2022, which also happened to be Mother's Day, and indeed Gerda's 98th birthday, that mother and daughter were reunited. Gerda and Sonia, separated for so long, were photographed holding so tightly onto each other, not wanting to let go. And Gerda just kept repeating the words, 80 years, 80 years, in bewilderment. And jokingly, her daughter said, Mom, stop, because you're giving away my age as well. And she said, I'm just so overjoyed to be able to say those words, my daughter. It means so much to have been able to live to see this moment. It's a compelling story of trauma, of turmoil, of loss and upheaval, followed by remembrance, reunion, and reconnection. We have loved ones, mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, husbands and wives, grandparents, people whom we will have had sadly taken from us, people whom we miss so much. We often think about them, and the reality is that one way or another, they're often on our minds. You know why? Because you don't just lose someone once. You lose them over and over again. And when that loss, momentary forgotten, creeps up and attacks you from behind, then fresh waves of emotion wash over you. And the realization that they are gone, it doesn't matter how many years later, hit home once more. And there are times that we will always wish that we could still reach out and connect with them and talk to them and seek their guidance. We know, and they certainly should know, that they're okay. We know they're somewhere else. We take comfort knowing that they are somewhere blissful and eternally perfect, peaceful, and pleasurable. But still, a piece of us aches for them, yearning for our past. When I think about my father, just Sunday night, Monday, marking 10 years of his passing, I reflect now more than ever how much I could use his sterling and advice during these past 10 years, in some ways more so than ever before. What would he say? What would he tell me to do? What would he advise my children, whom I could use still advice about and advise regarding them and what to do? But the truth is this. Even as we sometimes mistakenly assume that we are on our own, and to be sure, in every practical sense we are, make no mistake about it. Fundamental to Jewish belief is, as per the words that we say every Shabbat in our prayer service, "Bechayehem ubemotam lo nifradu," in their passing, just as in their lifetimes, our loved ones remain eminently connected to us, guiding us always in their own special way. Even as we might be separated for so long, in some ethereal way, yes, we can always reach out. And we can still, in some unique way, hold tightly onto them. Because the truth is, in the divine scheme of things, there are no death certificates. We're all familiar with the particular intervals throughout the course of the year when the barriers between heaven and earth are more palpably removed. It doesn't matter how many years have passed, those are moments of unique and great reunion when the spiritual energy is especially intense and tangible, whether particularly on a yard site or indeed at Yisker on special festivals. What is Yisker? What does it actually mean to remember? What is memory? Memory is a way of holding on to the things that you love, holding on to the things that you are, the things that you never want to lose. Memory is the power to revive again in our minds and in our hearts and in our souls those life experiences which, after having been imprinted, have disappeared or have been laid aside out of sight. In fact, you might describe memory very much like the caboose of a train. No matter how far ahead, no matter how distant you travel, the memories remain right behind you. You can try, for whatever the reasons, and shut them out, but you can never really hide from those memories. They're the past which you lived through, and frankly, they are the past which made you who you are, the person that you are now. They help to refresh your soul, to restore it, and to render it more fit for its prime function when looking forward. So on one level, on a most basic level, that is the power of Yisker. It's the power of memory. But Yisker is something so much more than that as well. And within that lies a certain truism that extends well beyond the Yisker moment and should give us comfort, even if only a grain of comfort, whenever thinking about or grappling with the loss of a loved one. The real reason why we are so drawn into the moment of Yisker is because somewhere deep down, we are acutely aware of the soul connections that take place between this world and the next. Somewhere deep down, we sense that there is more to life than just our mortal existence, that indeed there is somewhere beyond the here and now. And as such, our loved ones, though they may physically sleep, are never really gone. And that's why if we truly want to, we can feel their presence. We can actually feel our loved ones at any given moment in time. Because when you think about it, we are, after all, interconnected pieces of a soul. Why do we find that all too often our loved ones are suddenly on our minds? Why do we suddenly sometimes see them in a sunset or imagine their laughter in funny moments or feel their presence sometimes when we least expect it? Because they're there, every bit with us. The Rebbe once famously said, when you suddenly, inexplicably, find yourself thinking about a loved one, it's because in that precise moment, they're reaching out to you. Or as the Rebbe once said to a mother who sadly lost her son in the IDF during the Yom Kippur War, the relationship between loved ones is chiefly of a spiritual nature, much more so than that of a physical. And the Rebbe went on to explain further that the bond between a husband and wife, or between parent and child, or between siblings, you cannot describe that in any practical terms or in any physical terms. In fact, you can't describe it in any way whatsoever. It's something deep. It's something intrinsic. You can't describe the love that you have with your parent or your child in physical terms. It's deep. It's intrinsic. It's spiritual. And as such, even as the physical may be removed from our midst, said the Rebbe to this grieving mother, that spiritual bond, it remains intact for all of eternity. A parent continues to be a parent, a sibling, a spouse, and so forth. They all continue in that same capacity, albeit operating on a different level. So we still can connect with them. We can, in some very real way, still reach out to them. Even if we cannot see them, they can see us. Even if we cannot feel them, they can take us into their ethereal embrace. Even if we cannot hear them, they are whispering continuous love into our hearts. We actually know it to be true. We sense it to be real, and it impacts us, and it draws us in. In fact, if I may share with you, actually a little poem that really sums this up. Concentrate on the words. I came across this a little while ago, and it captures this very idea. Let the words resonate. I watch you every day. I'm always very near. I know deep in your heart, you know that I am here. I watch you when you sleep, in your bed, when at home. I hear you when you speak to me, especially when on your own. You cannot understand the reason I have gone, but I will never leave you. I'm here to keep you strong. Talk to me. I hear you, though you may not see. We share an unbroken bond that will always be. My passing won't keep us apart, for our souls are bound forever. Just feel me in your soul until one day we'll be together. So do not cry. Live your life every single day. Remember, you are not alone. I'm with you every step of the way. There was an old shul in a shtetl neighborhood that everyone went to. And there was one man in the shul who was deaf. And to everyone's surprise, he came to shul every single Shabbos. And he always davened. He prayed fervently and with tear-filled eyes because his son was the chazan. And though the deaf man obviously never heard his son's voice, he watched every motion, every gesture that his son was making. And he would stay until the very end of the prayers, no matter how long it took. And when the prayers ended, he would always be the first to go over and shake his son's hand to thank him for the davening. One year, right before Yom Kippur, The sun was setting fast, and everyone was waiting to begin Kol Nidre, but the chazan was nowhere to be seen. There was some tumult in the shul. People started to worry. The rabbi looks already, sees the entire shul full, but the deaf man's seat was empty, and suddenly the chazan bursts into the shul in his kittel and his long talus trailing behind him, and as he's rushing up quickly to the bima, he stops at his father's empty chair for just the briefest of moments, stares, pulls his talus over his head. Silence falls through the shul as the chazan took his place, surrounded by the holy Torahs, took a deep breath, and began Kol Nidre. And his voice was uniquely impacting that night, piercing the very gates of heaven. And every heart in that shul felt the impact and felt broken. Tears flowed so much that night. When he finished davening that evening, the rabbi went over to him and said, "I've got to ask, what were you thinking about that made you sing so differently tonight, that made you sing so well? Why was this year so special?" And the chazan looked to him with tears welling up in his eyes, and he said, "You know that my father was deaf, and just late last night, he passed away. This then would be the first time that my father actually heard me pray." The Torah itself actually conveys this truism of our loved ones being with us. When the fledgling Jewish nation are standing on the threshold of being able to enter into the land of Israel, they negotiate, as they do with a number of the different countries that they had to go through. One of them were the Edomites, and Moshe engages them, and Moshe actually says to them, "We need to pass through your land. We are, hey, distant relatives, right? You're a descendant of Esau, we're descendants of Yaakov, they were brothers, can we pass through your land?" And then he adds for emotional impact, "Listen, you know, we've had a hard time. We've been going at it really tough. We were slaves in Egypt and only managed to recently escape. We're finally heading to our promised homeland, and it would be really appreciated if you'd let us pass through." As it happens, they didn't allow, but that's by the by. Note Moshe's choice wording when appealing for permission to pass. "The Egyptians mistreated us and our forefathers." Who does he mean when he says our forefathers? They mistreated us. We're the ones who are in Egypt. What does he mean, our forefathers? Rashi, the famous commentary par excellence, says this refers to our forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who, though they were not actually with us in Egypt, nevertheless, the Egyptians mistreated us and our forefathers. Why? Because when Israel is afflicted with suffering, the patriarchs grieve in their grave. And as all the commentaries observe, the Torah is teaching us that our loved ones, again, remain eminently connected with us. They feel our pain in times of distress, and they yearn for our comfort as and when life will present its better moments. The Egyptians mistreated us, in other words, and by extension, our forefathers. Think about what that means. Think about the light that that sheds on the nature of intergenerational relationships. It's a remarkable concept. When we hurt, our grandparents, our parents, they cry. When we suffer, our ancestors grieve along with us. We have been molded and we have been shaped by those that came before us, and they remain eminently connected and affected by us. But we don't just receive from our gene pool. It's a reciprocal relationship. Whatever happens to us directly impacts on them, just like the newly discovered science of epigenetics has demonstrated that the joys and the traumas of the past can affect future generations. Conversely, we can influence those who lived before us. When the Torah recounts for us the very first outpouring of emotion over the loss of a loved one, it's when Abraham loses his beloved wife, Sarah. And the Torah doesn't hide the fact that Abraham cries over the loss. Lispod l'Sara v'lifkata, to eulogize over Sarah and indeed to cry over her. And yet in doing so, quite unusually, the Torah spells the word v'lifkata, to cry over her, with a small kaf. The middle letter there is smaller than the rest of the letters in the word. Why? What is being implied? That the crying was natural, the loss is real, But nevertheless, it was a contained crying. It was somewhat more controlled than just overwhelming grief and overwhelming loss. Why? Because Sarah didn't really die. She left Yitzchak in the world. She left a child. She left a noble giant. And when Sarah leaves and Isaac in the world, Abraham and the rest of the world feel comforted. When a Sarah leaves a Yitzchak, there is less sadness because she too continues to live on through him. She too then continues to live on forever. She passed on with a unique sense of fulfillment and contentment, knowing that she had a child that made it all worth it, that will continue to be a real source of blessing for humanity and the world. And so too, we, like Abraham, take heart knowing that even as our loved ones indeed sleep, they still live on. They live on in us, their children and grandchildren, parents, spouses, siblings. Again, we're all part of the same neshama, so part of their soul remains eminently connected to ours. The onus is in us to consider. Are we being everything that that loved one wants us to be? Are we endeavoring that we are continuing to be a source of blessing in the world? And bringing it home personally, in many ways, that idea always makes me feel closer to my father and more grateful for the love that I know that he continues to shower and to show me. Sometimes they are the ones that we talk to in our special place, wherever that might be, because they feel us. And I'm telling you, I mean, they really, really feel us. That's the point that Rashi was making. They, more than any, really, really know, more than anyone else, what we're actually going through. And reflecting on this paradigm of intergenerational relationships, that should mold our mindsets somewhat. The choices that therefore we make influence our children and influence our descendants. But they also reflect, to the credit or otherwise, of our ancestors. We are just but a link in that eternal chain, binding our past to our future, and it is our responsibility to protect them and make them proud of the choices that we make. So every now and then, I suggest to you it's worthwhile to take a moment and to ask yourself, what are the choices that you make? What are the heirlooms that you inherited, and what are the legacies that you are passing on? There was a young man who once came to a yechidus to have a private audience by the Rebbe following the untimely passing of his even younger son. And those who noticed him waiting outside for his yechidus, for this private audience, didn't know of his plight, but observed readily how he was standing there looking so sad, so downtrodden, so dejected. And then he goes into the room with the Rebbe, and he's in there for a period of time. And all of a sudden, when he emerges later from his yechidus, those same observers saw a smile on his face and a spring in his step. And they asked him, what happened? Why were you looking so sad before, and what transpired such that your mood changed so dramatically? And that's when he went on to explain, which they wouldn't have known before, that he had lost his young son. And when he went into the Rebbe's room, he just lost it all. He started to cry inconsolably. And the Rebbe sat there, looking on with deep emotion, feeling his pain. And then when he calmed, the Rebbe said to him the following. Or he repeated, he said, the Rebbe asked me the following. If you knew your son was well and somewhere safe and sound, and though you cannot communicate with him on a direct personal level, nevertheless, knowing that, would that not give you peace of mind? Would that not give you comfort? And the young man, of course, replied in the affirmative. And the Rebbe then continued and said, and if you could send gifts to your son, and you will know for certain that he is receiving those gifts, and he appreciates them immensely, only is unable to thank you for it personally, would you still send the gifts? And of course, the man again replied in the affirmative. And the Rebbe then went on to explain that every person, even as they pass from this world, they're simply going somewhere else, going to that one place where all is just and true, and they are well, and they are well looked after, and they are basking in the divine glory. And even as they can no longer in their realm of be able to achieve anything, to accomplish anything, because they're no longer in the realm of deed, so they cannot anymore do mitzvot for their own sake, down here, we can do so much in their merit that will give tremendous elevation to their soul. Every prayer uttered, every bit of Torah learnt, every good deed committed with them in mind gives immeasurable nachas, joy to their soul, to their neshamas. They watch over us. They can intercede on our behalf, and we can reciprocate as well. The relationship continues. The connection endures. To repeat a story that I actually shared last year at one of the dinners here, 64, 65 years ago, Arthur Garfunkel, a Jewish kid from Queens, enrolled in Columbia University. And during freshman orientation, Arthur met a student from Buffalo named Sandy Greenberg. And they immediately bonded over their shared passion for literature and music. And Arthur and Sandy, they became roommates and they became best friends. And with the idealism of youth that we can all relate to from back when, they promised to be there for each other no matter what, always through life. And soon after starting college, Sandy was struck by a calamity. His vision suddenly became terribly blurry, and as the problem grew worse, ultimately, he received the devastating news that glaucoma was destroying his optic nerves. The young man, Sandy, with such great prospects and a future, would soon be completely blind. And Sandy was devastated, and he fell into depression. And he gave up on the dream of becoming a lawyer, and he moved back to Buffalo, where he worried now about becoming a burden to his family. And the family would struggle even more so financially if they had to deal with him. And consumed with so much shame and so much fear, he literally cut off contact with everyone. He cut off all contact with any friends, refusing to answer letters or return phone calls, etc. But a promise is a promise. And suddenly his buddy, Arthur, turned up at his front door in Buffalo one cold winter morning. He wasn't going to allow his best friend to give up on life. So he had bought a ticket. He flew to Buffalo, unannounced, and Arthur convinced Sandy, "You've got to give college another go." And he promised that he would be there right by his side to make sure that he would never fall, he would never falter, literally or figuratively. And Arthur kept his promise, and he faithfully escorted Sandy around campus, and he always stayed by his side and effectively served as his eyes, guiding him every single step of the way. It was important to Arthur that even though Sandy had now been plunged into a world of darkness, he should never feel alone. And Arthur actually started to call himself darkness to demonstrate his empathy with his friend. He would say things like, "Darkness is going to read to you now. Darkness is going to take you for a walk now. Darkness is going to take you back to your room." And then one day, Arthur is guiding Sandy through crowded Grand Central Station when he suddenly said, I've suddenly realized I've got to go somewhere. And he literally abandoned him there, leaving him standing alone, petrified, for the first time without any vision, on his own entirely in this crowded station. And Sandy stumbled, and he bumped into people, and he fell, and he cut his knee. And after a couple of stressful hours, Sandy finally got on the right subway. And after exiting the station, with someone telling him that they are at 116th Street, he bumped into somebody who quickly said, "I'm so sorry, sir," and then recognized that that was indeed Arthur's voice. And then realized that his trusty friend had literally followed him the whole way home, making sure that he was safe, but did what he did deliberately in order to give him the priceless gift of independence. And Sandy actually said that that moment was the spark that caused him to live a completely different life, without fear, without doubt. And for that, he said, "I am grateful to," and I'll quote here for fun, "darkness, my old friend." Sandy graduated from Columbia earned graduate degrees of Harvard and Oxford, married his high school sweetheart, and became an extremely successful entrepreneur and philanthropist, wrote a book about his life. One day, early on, while at Oxford, Sandy got a call from Arthur. This time, Arthur was the one who needed help. He had formed a folk rock duo with his high school pal, Paul Simon, and they desperately needed $400 to record their first album. Sandy and his wife, Sue, had a negligible amount still at that point in their bank account, but without hesitation, he gave his old friend what he needed. Of course, Simon and Garfunkel did not start out as a success, but the lyrics of that one song, The Sound of Silence, was based, it is said, on that experience that one day at Grand Central Station, the opening line echoing what Sandy always said when greeting Art. Hello, darkness, my old friend. Art Garfunkel said, when he became friends with Sandy, my real life emerged. I became a better guy in my own eyes, and I began to see who I was, somebody who was able to give to a friend. And you know, friends, for too long we have been saying those words, hello, darkness, my old friend. Though to be sure, as familiar as we have become with darkness throughout our tumultuous history, it is far from a friend. We don't make peace with it, and we don't come to terms with it. The darkness presents in various guises and manifestations. Just reflecting on today's world alone, perhaps even indeed in this very room alone, we have some who have endured the ineffable darkness of pain, of illness, of personal loss, sometimes of untimely loss, and alas, much else besides. When King Solomon tells us in Ecclesiastes that to everything there is a season, a time to be born and a time to die, we imagine that time as placed in some distant and obscure future. It never occurs to us that it might have any connection with the day already begun. And then sometimes, God forbid, something suddenly happens. In fact, so suddenly, and the eventual certainty for us goes from obscure and distant to a very unreal reality. And in the process, we might become numb and we might grieve. How do we make sense of such tragedy? Well-meaning people will tell us it's all part of God's plan. But you know what? We cry out that while God certainly knows his plan, we do not. We are in pain. We cry out for some way to soothe the burning in our hearts. But while pain is, alas, inevitable in our exiled world, suffering is optional. When God brought the world into being, darkness pre-existed. And then one day, God created light, thus dispelling the darkness in the process. In the words of the Talmud, such is the way of creation. First comes darkness, then light. And so it continues. There are, alas, pockets of darkness in our world. Every time we endure loss, that for us is a moment of real darkness. But we have to take a page out of God's book, as it were. We have to be the light we wish to see in our world. We Jewish people have been conditioned to somehow emerge from the darkness, dust ourselves off, and build once more. And so it is in the face of every loss, just realizing, coming to understand, beginning to appreciate that the connections are real, that they remain, that we are eminently bound as one, helps us move past the darkness back into the light. Elie Wiesel wrote a book based on a real life experience. You may well have read it. It's called God on Trial. It was also subsequently made into a play. The most outstanding feature in this book, to my mind, is this. After the war, a group of Jews convened in a DP camp and decided to put God on trial for all the pain and all the trauma and all the loss and all the ineffable events that occurred in what is effectively probably the darkest moment in all of our history. And they had a judge, and they had a jury, and they had a defense lawyer, and they had a prosecutor. And in the end, they unanimously found God guilty. And the judge bangs his gavel and declares, the verdict is in. God has been found guilty. And then he looks at his watch and he says, right, the hour is late. Let's go daven mincha. That's the beautiful paradox of Jewish life and living. feeling the enormity of the pain, being acutely aware of the supposed, apparent injustices, and yet submitting to the reality that my thoughts are not your thoughts, says the Lord, and that in their passing, just as in their lifetime, they do not become separated. Yes, we are upset, but now let's go daven mincha. You know, musicians, when reading music, carefully observe the rest signs. It might well be that there's no music in the rest, but there is the making of music in the rest. Without the rest, you end up with a constant cacophony. And so it is. There are times when God might appear to be at rest, silent, as it were. But it is precisely in those moments when there is the making of man. How we deal with the struggle, how we cope with the loss, knowing that we are never alone, and that as we cross that sunlit strip which connects the departures of today and the reunions of tomorrow, no degree of worldly darkness can ever extinguish the glow of a soul's inner light. So it's not a matter of disregarding the past. It's not a matter of denying the reality of what happened. Quite the contrary. We know it. We recall it. We relive it constantly. We even have Yisker moments to focus on it. And sometimes, yes, our losses haunt us, and sometimes they plague us, and sometimes we cry. And that's okay, too. You know, we never realize the impressions we make on our children. I never realized the enormity of the impact on my kids, the fact that they never saw me cry. When my father-in-law sadly passed away a year ago, we were in that special building where they do the washing, the tahara, and they provide a final moment to be able to go into the room with the coffin and to be able to say goodbye. And just before I went into the room, I went into the adjacent room where my wife and my mother-in-law were sitting, along with my younger daughter, my 14-year-old daughter, and I wanted to convey a very important message of comfort to them. It was a Friday, and I wanted to share with them what the rabbis tell us about someone who is laid to rest on a Friday. That on that day, the Talmud tells us there is no judgment. That is to say, just as a Beth Din would never convene on a Friday down here because of the pending Shabbat, so the rabbis in the Talmud tell us it's the same up above. There's no court, there's no judgment on the Friday. And as I'm trying to communicate this to them, I suddenly find myself choking up, and then I lose it. I can't really properly complete. Everything about that moment brought back to me also the loss of my own father 9 years earlier. Later that day, I am with my younger daughter, and I see on her phone a text exchange between my two girls. Big daughter, who was out of the country at the time, to little daughter. Hey, sorry, are you okay? Little daughter, yes, I'm okay. It was all okay. But then dad came into the room, and dang, he got all emotional. Big daughter, he cried. Little daughter, yeah. Big daughter, oh, wow. What was that like? Never seen him like that. Little daughter, it was surreal. I mean, he's normally dry as a wall. And I just want to go on the record to say, well, first of all, you might be wondering why I was looking at my young daughter's phone and her text. Well, she lets me read her texts. But I want to go on the record to say I'm not. I'm really not. I just don't like to show emotion publicly. Indeed, when I visit my father's grave in Toronto, as I do each summer, as I did 3 days ago in Toronto, I insist often on going alone because I can then have a moment of true tears. I invariably always do. Yes, now even 10 years on. As I say, we can't ignore the gaping holes in our hearts. And tears are healthy. But rather than just grappling with despair, fundamental to Jewish thought is that it is far more effective to spread light than to expend energy fighting the darkness. We band together. We start seeing things differently in our own eyes. And in awareness of our own overwhelming vulnerability, we look to maximize our time here by being a source of light and making a difference onto others. There's a very moving story that is told by the Yiddish writer, Shalom Ash, about an elderly Jewish couple in Russia, who, as was the case often, were forced by the government to house a soldier in their home. And it was often a very uncomfortable and aggressive situation. They had to literally move out of their own bedroom, and the young man, all gruffness and glares, moves in with his backpack, with his rifle, with his bedroll. And then it's Friday night, and the couple prepares to sit down for Shabbat dinner. And the soldier, he takes his place at the table, only now it's apparent just how young he really is. And they see that properly for the first time. And he's sitting there and he's staring wide-eyed as the elderly woman is kindling the Shabbos candles. And then he listens as the older man is chanting the Kiddush and they're making hamotzi, and he quickly devours his own hunk of challah placed before him. And then he speaks pretty much for the first time. He asks for more challah. And then his face is a picture of bewilderment. Something about this scene, something about the candles and about the wine and about the challah, it all seems to be jogging something. This mysterious experience is triggering something in his mind and in his soul, and he can't quite put a finger on it. So he just suddenly, aggressively, gets up from his seat and beckons the old man to follow him back into the bedroom. And he pulls his heavy pack from the floor onto the bed. He starts pulling out a whole bunch of different things. He's pulling out his uniform and his equipment and his ammunition, until finally, at the very bottom, he pulls out a small velvet bag tied with a drawstring. And he says, "Can you tell me, perhaps, what on earth is this? I've been carrying this around for who knows how long," he says to the old man. And his eyes are soft now, and they're gentle, and they're imploring. The old man is somewhat frightened, nevertheless, takes the bag in trembling fingers, and he opens the string, and inside is a tiny little child's talus, like a talus cotton, a pair of tzitzis, and a tiny set of tefillin, and a small book of Hebrew prayers. And he looks to this big towering soldier and he says, "Where did you get this from?" He says, I've always had it with me. I don't know from when." And then the old man opens up the prayer book, the Siddur, and he reads the inscription and his own eyes fill with tears. "To our son, Yossel, taken from us as a boy, should you ever live to see your bar mitzvah and recognize your bar mitzvah, know that your mama and your tata always love you." Our mamas and our tatas and our babas and our zaydas and our great-grandparents for many generations, they love us. They're always with us. And they whisper to us continuously how much they love us. And it doesn't matter, as we said in our opening story, how many years have passed, the bond is eternal. The bond is timeless. And they always leave us special items: a talus, tefillin, prayer book, Torah, Shabbat candles, kashrus, mikvah, tzedakah, mezuzah. They've left us Jewish legacies, Jewish impressions, Jewish life lessons, traditions, all these various mitzvot. And when we embrace these mitzvot, we ensure that 3,335 years of Jewish history remains every bit alive. We ensure that every single Jew who ever walked the face of this earth is still, in some very real way, every bit alive. And we certainly ensure that those who left us these beautiful artifacts and these beautiful impressions on our hearts and souls continue to live on and remain every bit alive. That's what we have to strive to continue to do. Even as we consider the darkness endured, again, the loss, the pain, sometimes utter devastation, we have to determine how we can, with time, transform the darkness to light. Because to shine your brightest light is to be who you were always meant to be, is to be your true self. Or again, to quote the words of Elie Wiesel to fellow inmates in Auschwitz, "Muster your strength and don't lose heart. We shall see the day of liberation. Have faith in life." That's what we, God's chosen people, know how to do best. We muster the strength. We always believe in life. We have faith in the future. And above all else, we look constantly towards the day of our ultimate liberation. We don't know the meaning behind all the moving pieces in life. What we do know is that where you are, your opportunities, your gifts, even your challenges, your talents, your resources, and your difficulties, they're all part of that bigger puzzle. And when I wake up in the morning, and I have a very profound choice to make, either I become a victim of my circumstances, or I shrug my shoulders, or I become consumed with my loss, and I just figure out how to roll with the punches, or I rise to the challenges as they present themselves, I recognize the divinity in every single happenstance, and carpe diem, I make the most of every given moment in front of me as I strive to be an ambassador of truth and an ambassador of love and an ambassador of hope and an ambassador of healing and compassion. And so I'll end with this. A bereaved husband was feeling his loss keenly. And though decided distraction would be a good idea, he was going to go and travel abroad. And before his departure, he left directions for the tombstone with the inscription, "The light of my life has gone out." He ended up being abroad for a very considerable period of time, and as his good fortune, he found love again. And before his return, he had taken another wife. And before returning, he suddenly remembered the tombstone and the inscription. His new wife, he figures, might be offended. So he quickly contacted the stonemason. He says, "Look, I'm returning home. I'm getting on a flight soon. Circumstances have changed. I need you to use your years of experience to be creative, to be ingenious, come up with a better inscription." And upon his return, he took his new wife to see the tombstone, and he found the inscription had been made to read, "The light of my life has gone out, but I've struck another match." With the departure of our dearly departed, a light in our lives does go out. Initially, we think that a piece of us has essentially gone with them forever. But over time, we come to realize that actually, no, a piece of them continues to live on in us. We strike another match as we rekindle a new spark within our soul, in anticipation of giving nachas to our loved ones that were, in awareness of the deeper connections that are, and in the hope of being a light and an inspiration by passing the baton of Jewish life and tradition onto the next generation that will be. And even as you consider the priceless value, what you wouldn't give in being able to have a departed loved one back by your side, even for a few moments, ask yourself, nevertheless, how much are you currently investing in those loved ones that you still have with you as an integral part of your life? I'm not talking about the gifts you buy, the money you spend, the trips you take. I'm talking about the small, fundamental details in life that really, truly matter. Yeah, so we remember our late loved ones and what they brought into our lives, but we must also never lose sight of the present, to find the time to be every bit present, to be there for those whom we love and for those whom love you, and to do those little things for each other that matter every single day. Actually, as a final thought, do you know what most people's biggest fear is? Statistically, most people's biggest fear is actually public speaking. The second biggest fear is dying, which to my mind suggests when you're at a funeral, God forbid, it follows logically that more people would rather be in the box than delivering the eulogy. Friends, we're alive. We're here, Baruch Hashem, today. And until that point when God determines that our bodies are to be returned, ve'el afar toshuv, and to dust you shall return, until that fateful day, we have to banish our fears and our phobias, those things that just creep in and get in the way of life. We have to learn to live life to the full. We have to celebrate every single day with those nearest and dearest. We have to live, frankly, every single moment as we should, as though it were our last. We have to learn to explore and love our faith more. We have to appreciate and learn to trust and love God more. We have to learn to cherish and love our relationships more, and perhaps above all else, to be less fearful and love yourself a little bit more. Remember how to give nachas to your departed loved ones by undertaking something more spiritual on their merits. Remember to add purposefulness to your family by enhancing something within the spiritual ambience of your own home. And remember to live and to love, because that is the essence of life. May the souls of our dearly departed be bound in the bond of eternal life. And may you all live on in good health to inspire those who came before you and those who will walk after you, whereby we will merit the fulfillment of the words of our prophets, Valkitsu Viraninu Shokhne Ofer, that day when they promise us those who sleep will indeed rise up and dance with us once more and indeed forevermore. And to that, let us say, Amen.
Please visit myjli.com to learn more about JLI's multiple educational offerings.